So each one of you, the projects that you wrote me about could sustain an hour-long conversation.
I know. I'm embarrassed.
And they're all coming together in the next month or so. How did this come to be?
It's just serendipity that all these projects have actually converged. These are projects that have been in the making in one way or another for some time. The book that deals with my returning to downtown Mexico City, to the Jewish neighborhood, started really like as a magazine article 2-3 years ago. And after it was published in the periodical, there was interest from a publisher to turn it into a book.
As a student body, Amherst College is more diverse than ever, with, I understand, about 200 self-identified Latino or Hispanic students. From your perspective as a faculty member, what are some of the opportunities and challenges facing Latino undergraduates at Amherst College?
At Amherst College. Let me begin my answer by saying that I am thrilled that there has been such a transformation. When I first arrived in this place in the early 90s, there was already an attempt to diversify the student body, but it was an early and not tested attempt at that point. And I have been a witness to this transformation and a happy witness. It is not only that there are more Latinos at Amherst, but there are many other ethnic minorities, class minorities, and other groups. Some fears by members of the faculty that this would decrease our rigor as an institution, that it would water down the tradition that we have upheld for such long time, have proven to be wrong. It is a stronger place, it seems to me. It is much more a vanguard or cutting-edge place. And it certainly has strengthened the texture, the body that takes place in the classroom. I find the conversations to be very stimulating because people are coming from all walks of life in every sense, economic, ethnic, political. When it comes to Latinos, I have been in this few years really trying to push for that increase through articles and through public engagements. It is not an easy task, though, to have a diverse Latino population at Amherst. And as an institution, it seems to me that we still have much to learn. First of all, one needs to identify the fact that Latinos are a very heterogeneous and complex group of people, that this is a minority that is not defined by race or by language or by one particular geographical point, but that it comes from many different national backgrounds, that there are Latinos who speak Spanish and Latinos who don't speak Spanish, that there are white Latinos and black Latinos and Asian Latinos, that when it comes to religion, there are Buddhists and Catholics and Protestants and Jews and agnostics and atheists and so on. So what makes this group a group? I often think of it as a minority group, meaning that what it makes it a group is the fact that we're all together in a minority, but that the glue can be really can change depending on the perspective. Because we have those 200 plus Latino students coming from different walks of life, there are challenges that we face. Some of them are better prepared than others. Mm-hmm. Some of them are likely to have an easier time relating to other Latinos, whereas other Latinos might not. So there are issues of education that need to be paid attention to. The fact that somebody comes from a protected and elite school and makes it to Amherst and is Latino is different from somebody who comes from a public school and is Latino and is from a different background. And those two individuals here meet for the first time. And that can be as much of a shock as meeting other people that are not Latinos. There is also a group that I want to acknowledge here that to me seems very important, and it is a task that this institution needs to be paying attention because of the privileged position in which we find ourselves, and that is the undocumented students. In the last few years, small liberal arts colleges, realizing that they have a certain freedom because they are not dependent on federal money, are able to allow undocumented students into their student body, which is a responsibility we all have. This is a population of between 5 and 7 million people that are of student age. And if we don't do something before the politicians actually make up their mind if they are going to endorse or not endorse the DREAM Act, we are going to keep this population down outside of the channels of assimilation and improvement and into the middle class. It's very important that this group is here. The numbers are small. They are also present in other small liberal arts colleges. I would say that almost every major institution in this country right now has undocumented students, yeah. Sometimes in a recognized way, that is, the administration knows about them, and sometimes in an unrecognized way, that is, the undocumented students are there without having told anybody that they are undocumented. It is a fine line to walk there. Do we call attention to this or do we not? And in some ways, Peter, it reminds me of the dilemma that a person who is gay has in coming out of the closet, not only for the individuals, but for the institutions. Do we acknowledge this hidden identity that we have, and in acknowledging it, we improve the situation, but also get in trouble? Or do we quiet, do we remain secretive about it, and thus delay any possibilities of improving the situation? I am for dialogue. I am also for putting pressure through dialogue to politicians that are just procrastinating something that is inevitable. These children grew up here. They are ours as a society, and we are their parents and their teachers and their mentors the way we are of anybody else. We can't keep the bastard son in the closet. Being at the cutting edge when it comes to diversity, I'm going to bring here a line from Superman. With power comes responsibility. I think that what we have accomplished in the last 5-6 years means that we have a responsibility to reflect and explore the consequences of this and not, you know, kind of fall back on our and celebrate our laurels and say we've made it and then we're not going to see what the consequences are.
I believe your father refers to you in that book as muy prolífico, and that's certainly true. Can you offer any sort of insight on what a kind of typical day, week is for you in terms of juggling all these projects?
I sometimes dodge the question by saying, who, me? I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. And I do so because I think that by calling attention to the number of things, I'm diminishing the possible attention to the quality of the things. I think to myself, in doing so many things, am I doing each and every one of them with less attention, with less concentration, with less amount of talent? And my answer is no. There are some of us who spend our lives building one house, and there are some of us who spend our life moving from one house that we build to another and feeling that those various habitats are ours. I'm really just an average man. I sleep my regular hours. I sleep 7 to 8 hours every night. You see me in the gym. I go running. I have lunch with students or with friends or with my lovely wife every day. My weekends are with kids, at the movies, watching football, soccer. Maybe each of us has written in the forehead how many words are we going to be able to utter in a lifetime, and how many words are we going to be able to write. And maybe someone up there kind of screwed up the numbers and gave me more than my fair chance.
You mentioned that it's National Poetry Month, and the book that you've edited, the book of 20th century Latin American poetry, is being released in paperback this month after hard copy publication last year. What was the original impetus behind this project, which features poems in the original Spanish and then in translation?
One of them was that we often recognize or acknowledge that Latin America has been an engine of extraordinary fiction, of great novels, great short stories, great nonfiction books that deal with the magical and the exotic. And this has come at the expense of this other extraordinary facet of Latin American literature, which has been poetry. Poetry is less well-known, more marginal, less an export item. The truth is that Latin America is as much an engine of great poems where politics and society come together, or where the exploration of our role in the universe is indulged. And I wanted to create a portable library that would allow people the possibility of, at the very least, grasping some of the great poetic efforts that have been done.
So in Return to Centro Histórico, you cite some demographic statistics, and for example, that about 1 in 5,000 Mexicans is Jewish, and there are perhaps 35,000 Jews in Mexico in total, and that typical career paths are medicine, education, and business. And you say also that Mexican Jews tend to be apolitical. Why do you think that is, and does that describe you as well?
No, it doesn't describe me. At one point, the Los Angeles Times wrote an article about me that it was titled "The Accidental Mexican." And I think that is an accurate description. And I'm very thankful to what the country gave my ancestors, my grandparents and my parents. And if I left it to come to the United States, it doesn't mean that I have in any way diminished my love for it. The Mexican Jewish community is small, insular. By insular, I mean inward-looking. It is a community that has protected itself by not engaging in larger aspects of Mexican life, and only those that see themselves, and here's where I fit, as rebels, children that go against the parameters of their parents, that some Jews have gotten involved in politics and in the arts. In my case, I wanted to be a writer. I didn't think that I could write about Jewish topics in Mexico, and that prompted me to come to the United States. I never imagined myself being a teacher or following an academic path. I really never imagined myself writing in English.
It seems that, and maybe just my observation, but I have seen some survey research that backs this up, that especially in New England, the society is fairly secular and that religion does not tend to be a core part of people's identity. Yet it seems that religion for you definitely became a strong part of your identity.
Sure.
As you entered young adulthood. I was curious how that process took place and how important was religion to you during your childhood, and how important is it today?
Yeah, very good question. My parents were not really Orthodox Jews. They kept the very basic rituals, the big high holidays, Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah and Passover. But there were not regular Shabbat candles, for instance, every Friday night. You know, the house was kosher, but it wasn't, if we went outside, we didn't have to keep kosher. For us, culture was a form of religion. The fact that we had Yiddish, the fact that our ancestors were survivors or relatives of those who had perished in the Holocaust, meant that we had a duty to be Jewish. Not religiously, but culturally. We needed to prove those who had tried to destroy the people that we had endured, and not only had endured and survived, but that we had something in us that we still wanted to keep. That was a very difficult situation because there was the kind of survivor's mentality. Oh, I am doing this because my family was almost wiped out. When I discovered religion in my youth, it was more an intellectual endeavor than a spiritual endeavor. I was very interested in the mechanics of how theology was built, how did we reach the conceptions of God that we have, the differences between Catholicism and Protestantism and Judaism and Islam. I'm a believer, although a skeptic. I believe in God with many doubts.
Another project is the photo novella,
yeah,
and the exhibit that will be at the National Yiddish Book Center at the end of April. And this was a graphic novel about the terrorist attack against the Jewish Community Center in Argentina in 1994. This, to some extent, was a exploration also of the extent of anti-Semitism.
Sure.
I think it observes in there, even though it was Spanish and my Spanish is not very good, that many top Nazi leaders were granted asylum in Argentina.
Sure.
And they often ended up in neighborhoods that were populated by Jews.
Sure.
Tell me maybe a little bit about that tension and also your thoughts on the prevalence and intensity of anti-Semitism in Latin American countries.
I believe that it is time for us to start thinking about Hispanic anti-Semitism as its own category. I don't think that there is much use anymore in talking about anti-Semitism in general. I think anti-Semitism is always local. So Nazi anti-Semitism is very different from Arab anti-Semitism. American anti-Semitism is different from European anti-Semitism. And I think it's time to talk about Hispanic anti-Semitism in its own terms, going back to the period of the Inquisition, very rooted in the presence of the Catholic Church manipulating information about the Jews as Christ killers and the witnesses of the plight of Jesus. In Latin America, anti-Semitism also is, to a large degree, combined with the animosity that exists in mostly left-leaning circles against the State of Israel. There's a duality between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism that sometimes get conflated. What happened in Argentina in 1994 was an anti-Zionist attack that really passes as an anti-Semitic attack. It was against the Jewish Community Center, but it was motivated by forces that came from Hezbollah and from Iran. And rather than going against the State of Israel, they go against the vulnerable community in Latin America that is ill-prepared in terms of security. In this particular fotonovela, the idea was to be able to speculate what exactly was in the minds of those terrorists and what happened, because at that time the president of Argentina was of Lebanese and Ottoman descent. To this day, there is no closure. Nobody really knows exactly what happened at the very beginning, before the explosion. The explosion happened at 9:53 in the morning. So the fotonovela wants to use art, photography, the creativity of literature to speculate based on, rooted on facts. Who was it? And what was that? And why in that neighborhood?
We talked about the Latino USA cartoon history a little bit. The book portrays highlights of the Latino impact and achievement in U.S. history, politics, and culture. Very kind of diverse and eclectic, very serious subject matter, but then you also leaven it with entertainment, popular culture. The 15th anniversary brings us up to date. What do you predict for Latino USA in the future? Latino president, perhaps?
Well, we're 50 million, as I mentioned before. I don't think we can have a Latino president very soon. I hope I'm wrong. I don't think we can, because the Latino community remains very fractured politically and culturally and economically. But that doesn't mean that a vice president cannot be chosen that is a Latino. And certainly as the election approaches, it would be wise but challenging for the Republican candidate to choose a Latino, because the question would immediately be, what kind of Latino? Is it a Cuban? Is it a Mexican? Or another type of Latino that is more neutral? I foresee a couple of decades ahead of us in which Latinos finally enter the middle class in big numbers. And if that happens, then the whole country is going to be better off. If that doesn't happen, then it's not only bad for the Latino community, but bad for the entire country, because we will have a ghettoized working class that has little access to power and education, and we will all have to pay for it. Riots, protests, and crime, and so on. It is in the best interest of the rest of us to make room for Latinos the way we should.